This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Emily Anthes, a journalist and author who specializes in telling the stories of science. Her work has appeared in Wired, Scientific American, Slate, Psychology Today, the Boston Globe, and other publications. She holds a master's degree in science writing from MIT and a bachelor's degree in the history of science and medicine from Yale. Emily Anthes is here today to tell us about her book, Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts, published in 2013. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
What led you to write your book, Frankenstein's Cat? What is your goal?
It started just from observing the kinds of news stories I was seeing on a daily basis. I read a lot of science media, and it seems like every week or two I would see a news story about some crazy creature that scientists were creating. And I had mixed feelings about these developments, to be honest. My first reaction, I'm a science geek, so I thought it was really cool that scientists could create glowing cats or spider goats, as they were called. But I've also always loved animals, and so I felt a little guilty for thinking that these advances were cool. So I was trying to sort of figure out my own feelings, and I realized that though we have a lot of discussions about what biotechnology means for humans, there is not a lot of talk about what it means for the animals themselves. And so I'm just sort of hoping to start that discussion.
Would you give an overview of the types of animal biotechnology you talk about in your book?
Sure. It's really wide-ranging. So I start with genetic technology, things like genetic engineering, in which scientists can take, for instance, a gene from one species and put it into another. I talk about cloning, the cloning of livestock and pets, and also some scientists who are trying to clone endangered species. And then I also move on to talk about ways in which we can change animal bodies from the outside. So I have a chapter on high-tech animal prosthetics and animal tagging and tracking devices. And then I end with sort of the most sci-fi seeming applications of all, which is cybernetics and the creation of these cyborg insects and rodents.
What are some of the underlying reasons or motives for using biotechnology in regard to animals?
One of the most basic motives is simply to unravel some basic research questions. So often scientists will genetically engineer a rodent so they can see how different genes work in a species and what happens if you disrupt them. Or another big usage is to engineer animals that suffer from various diseases so that scientists can then study those diseases and maybe test out potential treatments and cures. But there are also real-world applications. The cyborg remote-controlled beetles and rodents, for instance, one proposed application is maybe these animals could be used, say, after an earthquake, and they could be steered around inside rubble and help search teams pinpoint the location of human survivors. So it really runs the gamut.
Who or what types of organizations are primarily responsible for the work going on in animal biotechnology?
Right now, it's mostly university researchers, often with grants from the federal government. There are, of course, entrepreneurs in this space and a lot of startup companies, but most of these companies have not gotten very far or become huge yet, particularly in the animal genetic engineering field. There's still a lot of uncertainty about whether the public will accept these animals and how the government will regulate them. And so I think entrepreneurs are a little bit hesitant to put too much money behind these advances without really knowing if they'll make it to market.
Would you tell us about turning animals into pharmaceutical factories? That's one of the chapters in your book.
So this is a field known as farming, spelled with a PH, sort of a combination of pharmaceuticals and farming. And the idea is based on the notion that some of the compounds that our body makes naturally are really good medicine and can be used to treat various human ailments, like clotting factors and antibodies. But the trouble is that it's hard to make these compounds on an industrial scale. They're very finicky and they're complex. So in the 80s, scientists realized that dairy animals are actually experts at producing complex proteins. After all, their udders are full of milk, which is chock full of proteins. So the idea is that you put, say, a gene for an antibody you're interested in into a cow or a goat, and if you put it under the control of sort of just the right genetic switch, then when the animal starts to lactate, its udder will fill with milk that contains this human medicinal protein. You can then milk the animal and purify the protein and use it to treat human patients.
What are some specific examples that have actually been put into practice?
So there's one drug already on the market. It's called Atrin, and it's the first genetically engineered animal drug. It's made by a company based in Massachusetts, and it's essentially a clotting factor known as antithrombin. That's something that our bodies make naturally and sort of keep our blood from forming dangerous clots. Some humans, though, are born with a genetic mutation and they don't make enough antithrombin, so they're at risk for serious blood clots. So the scientists at this company, which is called GTC, engineered goats that make antithrombin in their milk. And they have a herd of goats up in Massachusetts, and the milk turns into antithrombin. And it's been approved by the EU and the FDA, and it's on the market now.
What are the conversations about the implications of combining human with animal DNA, which has been done in this case?
There's a lot of discussion about that, about the ethical and philosophical questions it raises. Sometimes it involves animal welfare. There are concerns about whether this genetic tinkering might harm the animal or cause animal suffering. But often it's more of a philosophical discussion of what it means to cross these species boundaries. And I think especially when you're dealing with human DNA, it can be unsettling to think that we can make a piece of our own genomes work in another species. It sort of raises questions about, if we can do that, is there really a strong dividing line that separates us from these animals? These questions get especially complex when you think about modifying animal brains, which scientists have done. They've created animals that have human brain cells in their brains. And so then that raises questions about, how should we treat these animals if they have human-like characteristics? Do they get human-like rights? So there are a lot of things to think about.
In regard to the farm animals, another example you speak about is the production of lysozyme, which can be used to fight diarrhea. Would you say more about that?
Sure. So lysozyme is another protein that our bodies normally make, and it's an antimicrobial protein. It's really potent at sort of bursting bacterial cells. As it happens, human breast milk is really concentrated in lysozyme. And scientists think that perhaps that's one reason why kids who are breastfed might have healthier digestive systems. But childhood diarrheal disease is a huge problem worldwide. We don't see it so much in the U.S., but it causes millions of deaths every year. So scientists wondered if there was a way to get more lysozyme to these kids, especially if they're not being breastfed or maybe they're too old to be breastfed. So they've engineered a herd of goats that makes a high concentration of lysozyme in their milk. And there haven't been human trials yet, but there have been a number of studies that show that this genetically modified goat's milk protects the guts of pigs and keeps them from getting some of these diseases like E. coli. So it has potential maybe to help alleviate this global toll of diarrheal disease.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Emily Anthes, author of the book Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you now tell us about the work on cyborg insects and rats? What is being done and for what reasons?
So this is work that the U.S. military is really interested in, especially the insect work. As most people probably know, the military is interested in drones and sort of unmanned flying vehicles. And they're especially interested in very tiny flying vehicles that maybe are unobtrusive. The problem is it's hard to engineer these robots, especially because they need a source of power. And if it's very small, it can't really carry a battery that powers it for that long. So engineers realized that, of course, insects power themselves and they already know how to fly. So really, if we could just sort of take control of their movements, we would have the little drones that the military wants. So scientists at a couple different institutions have created these remote-controlled insects. They essentially will put electrodes and wires into maybe the wings and the brain of a beetle, and they can sort of force the beetle to start and stop flying and to turn left and turn right. It's still a little bit crude. We don't have super precise control over their movements, but it's pretty astonishing what they've been able to accomplish already.
Would you now talk about the cyborg rats?
So the rats are a little bit different, but it's a DARPA-funded project. And they have, again, wires that go into their brain, and researchers can send them signals to either turn right or turn left. And when the rodent does what the researcher wants, they can send another signal essentially into the rat's pleasure center of the brain. So it acts as a reward for doing the right thing. And these rats can then be navigated through obstacle courses. The idea is, again, maybe that they could be steered through rubble or they could be used to detect mines. The rats themselves are too light to set off the mines, so maybe they could be trained to sort of sniff them out.
What has been the discussion around the ethics of taking control of an animal's nervous system?
Intense discussions. It's obviously sort of one of the most troubling things I talk about and one of the most extreme. You know, people who are concerned about animal welfare, which is most of us, often think that one of our duties to animals is non-interference, that we should essentially leave them alone to live their own lives. Obviously, this is a pretty extreme violation of that notion. What I did find encouraging, though, is that the researchers who do this work are very much engaged in and aware of that discussion. They know that the work they're doing raises ethical concerns, and they're happy to sort of talk through those concerns with people. They're not blind to the implications of and opposition to what they're doing.
Would you say more about what the researchers say about their own work in this regard?
Sure. So one of the researchers who's built the remote control beetle that I talked about sort of knows that this is troubling and troubling research that not everyone is going to agree with. He happens to think that it's worthwhile because the insects experience very little pain, no pain. They're anesthetized before these procedures, and he thinks it really has the potential to save human lives. But he also knows that not everyone will agree with that idea. And he recognizes that we're going to have the increasing ability to take control over animal bodies and brains in the future. And so he says that one of the ways his work can be helpful is to start that discussion, because until now, maybe it wouldn't have occurred to us to have these conversations. And why would we if cyborgs seem like science fiction? So it gives us a chance to have sort of a dialogue as a society about whether this is something we really want to do. He thinks yes, but he's aware that not everyone will agree.
Another type of biotechnology you speak about is cloning animals. What is being done here and for what reasons?
It depends on the animals we're talking about. So from sort of the most quote-unquote frivolous, we can talk about cloning pets. Right now, that's mostly dogs. There are two companies in Korea that will clone your dog. It's still very expensive, six figures, so it has not been super popular, but there are a handful of dog owners in the U.S. who have had their dogs cloned. There's also the cloning of livestock. That's more popular and used more in the U.S. than I realized when I started. There are several hundred cattle clones born here every year, which is more than I expected. And livestock owners really see cloning as an opportunity to make exact copies of their best performers, say cows that make the most milk or bulls that have various physical traits that they desire. It's still not mainstream, but it's an option now for livestock owners. Then there's also the idea of cloning endangered species. And this is still a bit experimental, but scientists have managed to clone some endangered species, a lot of cats, African wild cats, and the gray wolf, a couple endangered species of cattle. And they sort of speculate that perhaps cloning has a role to play in conservation. Right now, it's still laboratory bound, but they're thinking about the future.
What are the issues around biodiversity or genetic diversity within a species?
Of course, that's a huge issue with cloning. Endangered species don't just suffer from low numbers, but they often struggle with not enough genetic diversity. So cloning obviously doesn't solve that problem because it just gives you exact copies of animals you already have. But in theory, it could be used to help maintain the diversity that currently exists. For instance, if animals die without reproducing or are infertile, then cloning gives researchers an opportunity to essentially try again with that animal's genes. There's also some talk about using what are known as frozen zoos more. So these are essentially tanks of liquid nitrogen where cells and DNA samples are stored from different creatures. And so far, it's mostly been endangered and exotic species that researchers are collecting cells from. But one scientist I talked to said that really what he thinks we should be doing is systematically taking DNA samples from all sorts of species that are not endangered currently. So the idea might be if in 100 years there is a collapse of genetic diversity, perhaps we can bring back some of those old genes through cloning. So it's not a cure-all and it's not going to solve the genetic diversity problem, but it could be a useful tool in limited ways.
To what extent have the clones been defective or unhealthy?
In terms of the endangered species cloning, I have not seen a lot of reports of defective or damaged clones themselves. What is true about cloning, though, is it's incredibly inefficient. So these researchers, for instance, might create 30, 50, 100 cloned embryos, and only one makes it to term. And from what we can tell, that one that is born seems to live a normal life. It's a little hard to say because there haven't been a lot of data points. But what happens on the road to that one clone being born is there are stillbirths, there are premature births, there are severe birth defects. So there are still things researchers need to iron out. And if there's any hope of using cloning in conservation, we definitely need to figure out how to make it work with sort of less of this collateral damage.
What's known about the ability of the clones themselves to reproduce and have healthy offspring?
That is actually one of the few questions around cloning that seems to be pretty settled, which is that clones themselves sometimes struggle right when they're born, but if they can sort of be ushered through the early weeks and months of their lives, they seem to develop into healthy adults. And all the research shows that they reproduce perfectly normally, that their offspring are not only healthy, but indistinguishable from other offspring. Most of this data comes from looking at cows, which has been the species that's been the most cloned, but they seem to reproduce totally normally.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Emily Anthes, author of the book Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beasts. What seems to be the response to the use of biotechnology for animals? How much acceptance has there been from the government and from the public?
Those are two slightly different questions.
Okay.
I think the public's feeling is mixed. There are definitely some very vocal critics, but I think that's actually a pretty small minority of the population. I think a lot of people have similar feelings to what I had going into this project, which is it seems kind of cool, but it also seems a little bit unsettling. And in a lot of surveys, people say they simply don't know much about these technologies. So I really think the first task is to sort of improve education, and not just in a general sense. I think it's hard to really wrap your mind around just the idea of cloning or genetic engineering, but just present specific cases and specific applications of this is how we could use this technology or this is how it's being used. I think a lot of people are hungry for more information and would love to see what these techniques mean in practice. The government is a little bit of an interesting case right now. In 2009, the FDA finally put into place a procedure that, for instance, entrepreneurs or companies have to go through to get a genetically engineered animal onto the marketplace. And they have said that it's going to be a purely science-based process. But politics seems to keep worming its way in. There are some politicians who are opposed to genetic engineering for various reasons. And so a lot of scientists are sort of waiting to see whether the government's really going to let these animals on the market.
To what extent do you see the application of biotechnology to animals as being qualitatively different from what we are doing already? Because many people use animals for food and improve their use in medical research.
Right. And one of the things I try to do in the book is to put these technologies in context. For instance, if you look at the dog, that's a species that we have shaped hugely through our intervention just using selective breeding. So the ability to reshape animal bodies is not new. Our new technologies give us more control over, for instance, the genome itself. They let us make changes faster and in more extreme ways. So it's definitely an escalation of what we could do before. But I think the ethical issues fundamentally do not change. The question about whether we alter animals and for what reason are the same that they've always been. I think maybe biotechnology makes those questions more urgent and more crucial to start having those conversations. But it's not just biotechnology that raises concerns. There are plenty of things wrong with selective breeding, too.
Looking at the work that's being done as a whole, what do you see as the major perils or drawbacks of genetically engineering animals?
There are a lot of different fears that get raised. I'm not too concerned with sort of the philosophical notion that these things are quote-unquote unnatural, partly because of what I've just said, that we've created lots of animals that would not otherwise exist in nature. But I think one of the most real worrisome concerns is about what might happen if these animals made their way into the ecosystem. And that's something that scientists are aware of, and there are various precautions in place to prevent genetically engineered super creatures from escaping the lab. But those are real discussions that are worth having. We simply don't know what might happen if an altered animal were released into or escaped into the wild and what it might do to throw off the whole balance of an ecosystem.
In your book, you say that if we reject use of biotechnology wholesale for animals, we reject the good with the bad. Would you explain?
Sure. I think there's a tendency to either reject all biotechnology as evil or to accept it all as, you know, the savior of the planet. And I really don't think that it's inherently good or bad. It's simply a set of techniques, and sort of the ethical implications depend on each application and how we're using them. I think there are certainly things that we may not want to do. There might be alterations that are dangerous to us or the animals or the environment, and we should absolutely reject them. But there's also real potential. There are scientists who are working, for instance, to create chickens that don't get or spread the avian flu. And that could be, if it's done right, great for chickens and birds and also good for humans. And so I think if we reject all genetic engineering, we're rejecting very promising applications like that.
Would you say more about the ways that animal biotechnology might help animals?
Sure. And that's something I focus a lot on in the book. There are ways, as I was just talking about, to potentially genetically engineer animals that are resistant to certain diseases. Scientists have also cloned animals that have a natural resistance to disease. So there's a bull in Texas that is a clone, and he's naturally resistant to a pretty nasty livestock disease. So one potential proposal might be to use bulls like that as sort of breeding stock for a new disease-resistant population. There's also gene therapy, which is sort of a relatively new procedure in which scientists or doctors inject a functional gene into an animal that has a genetic disorder. And it's actually been used in dogs to restore the sight of blind dogs. These dogs were born blind, and scientists injected a particular gene into their eyes and suddenly they could see. So that's a particularly exciting development.
What guidelines would you propose for the use of animal biotechnology?
Man, that's a tough and difficult question. I think we probably need a set of different guidelines. There's a big difference, I think, between using these technologies for pets versus for things that are meant to be eaten versus wild animals. And I think there are different questions we have to ask. But in general, I think, you know, showing that the particular change you're making doesn't cause animal suffering is one. And basically the principle of do no harm, I guess, that it doesn't cause suffering to the animal, that it doesn't cause some disastrous consequence for humans, and that it doesn't destroy or disrupt ecosystems. I think those are the three criteria we need to think about.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
Well, I don't intend my book to be the final word on any of these subjects, partly because the science is changing a lot, and partly because I know others will have different opinions than me, and that's fine. But I don't think there's been a lot of discussion about what biotechnology really means for animals themselves. And so if this book starts that discussion and gets people thinking and talking about these issues, then I'll consider it a success.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think you may have already gotten at it a little bit earlier, but just that there is not sort of a blanket evil biotechnological industrial complex, that there are certainly reasons to be careful and to be cautious and maybe to reject some of these applications. But I hope that we don't have a knee-jerk reaction against all biotechnology, because then I think we really lose some very promising advances.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Emily.
Thank you for having me.
You were just listening to Emily Anthes, author of the book Frankenstein's Cat, Cuddling Up to Biotech's Brave New Beast, published in 2013 by Scientific American and Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. For more information, check on the web at emilyanthes.com. Again, that's emilyanthes.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the Streaming Archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.